Hi, everyone, and welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Property Investment Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima McGinn. Great to have you with us today. Glad you could tune in, and thank you for your patience in recent weeks. I've been a bit irregular with the new episodes for the past 3 weeks or so, mainly due to the fact that I've been in Australia, Gold Coast, Australia, to be more precise, on a family holiday, which makes it a little bit hard to create that quiet environment that's needed for recording this podcast. In fact, even the few precious minutes in which I'm speaking to you right now have been hard to come by, let alone the 10 or 20 minutes needed for a full podcast episode. However, I wouldn't want to leave you without your Japan property investment fix. And since I've also had the pleasure of speaking at a short seminar here in Brisbane, Australia last week, which has been recorded, although not at the highest quality, I thought I'd share the Q&A section of that seminar with you. The presentation section was probably already quite familiar to those of you who have been following this podcast for a while, but the Q&A session, which had more info about our company and fee structure, other options for first-time investors to Japan, financing, and other juicy topics, that's probably worth a listen to. If you can brave through the first few minutes or so, the recording does become a lot clearer about halfway in. So here we go, a Q&A session from our Brisbane, Australia, Japan Real Estate Property Investment Seminar. Enjoy.
Your one, two-bedroom apartment at most, and to generate those 8, 9, 10% returns that we've seen. Mm-hmm. The bigger ones just will not get that much, but if prices do go up, then they stand to gain more. They've got a larger land footprint per year.
And just being an Aussie, haven't asked any questions. What percentage do you take as an agent collecting rent on behalf of Australian owners?
We're not the agents, we're on top of that. And if you deal directly with real estate agents, they charge, depending on the price of the property, between 3.5% to 5.5%. So it goes up gradually. The property managers charge between 3% to 5% of the gross rental income per month for management. And building fees vary, so depending on how fancy or how old the building is, they can be anywhere from 10% of your gross rental to 30, 35% of your gross rental. And if you need somebody like us to help you just centralize things, to like be a one-stop shop kind of thing, and to give you local know-how, we charge 4 or 5% depending on the value of the property on the purchase, and 2 or 3% depending on the gross rental income for the monthly portfolio management. So that includes your balance sheets, managing your banking for you, collecting your income, paying your expenses, and dealing with
the Japanese-speaking property managers.
Yes.
On your behalf.
That's right.
So that 4 to 5% you charge for the transactions over and above the agent fee?
That's correct.
Yes.
But we provide, obviously, due diligence, we provide negotiation service, we tell you if it's reasonable to negotiate this property down and so forth, so it usually works out to be about the same amount. And on the monthly, it's with 3 to 5 for the PM, and then another 2 or 3 for us. Yeah, if you need our help, I mean, we've got people who have Japanese spouses or Japanese residency that they've had in the past, and they've still got their bank account, and they might be happy to manage everything on their own. So it's up to you the level of service you need from us. But again, it's not just us. I mean, if you're happy to talk to a few entities, and you're not really keen on having just this one single point of contact, then every city will have at least one or two real estate agents who will have English-speaking staff, to a point, as well as property managers. Insurance, building management might be tough, but the property manager potentially could help you with that if you find an English-speaking one. But if you're planning a portfolio, then you need to find the ones that speak English in each and every city you're going to be investing in. So you've just got a few points of contact there. If you're happy with that, you don't need anyone like that.
Just the tax.
A bit more comfortable than Australia, but it's not Singapore. So income tax, assuming individual or not corporate ownership. So income tax starts at about 380,000 Japanese yen net per year. So about 4,000 Australian net per year. But you can carry your purchase costs 3 years forward. So most people, if they have one or two units, wouldn't be paying anything at all. They'd be under the reporting threshold. And even the ones that have larger portfolios, first 3 to 5 years in tax free. And it goes up to 5% at that level for every yen thereafter. So the 380 is still free, and then from 381 you pay 10% per yen up until about 22,000 odds per year, where it goes up to 10%. And so forth. So
quite that, that means the Australia also has to pay the Japanese tax.
Absolutely. Yeah. Japan and Australia have an income tax treaty, so you're not going to be taxed twice. You pay what you need to pay in Japan, and then
it will be offset.
So yeah, oh, offset. Yeah, 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 yeah.
So then they offset whatever you paid there when you pay your income tax back here.
So what company tax? Circa 30%, is it?
30%.
Yeah. So purchasing through a corporate entity, is that a?
It's a feasible option if you're planning for a bigger portfolio. Mm. There are a lot of deductions that you just can't claim as an individual. And if you've got a mother company overseas, they can transfer funds across free of charge as a loan to the daughter company and so forth. From what the accountant, most of our customers use, estimates, if you're not planning for a portfolio that's going to be $1 million or over, if you're just going to have a few apartments, it's probably not worth it. But again, case by case, you have to speak to an accountant on that. Capital gains tax, if you sell within 5 years, it's actually 39% at the moment. After those 5 years, it halves to 18 or 19%.
You had a question?
Back to the tax.
Sorry, here we go.
Back to my tax.
Yep.
You only say $50,000 in Australia and then like $3,000 from the office in Japan. Does that mean you have to pay the Australian tax after $3,000?
That's right. So you'd be tax-free in Japan, but as far as I'm aware, Australian legislation does require you to declare that even if it's tax-free there, and then you'll be paying whatever you pay here on that $3,000. You're just not double tax. You're not double tax, that's it.
Are your airfares covered if you go over to buy something? Not like on the Australian tax?
They're deductible, yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I don't think you're going to get paid back for it. But
no, I guess so. If someone flies over and pays like you said before, $4,000 apartment, and you spend $1,000 on airfare, they are tax deductible. Yeah, that's assuming that you've gone over there.
Yeah, just make sure that you've actually got an itinerary that shows that you're going to that place where you purchased property. But yeah.
And one more. What is the most typical repeat customer you would have? If you can give us an Australian as an example.
Australians are usually professional couples. We get couples probably starting around 35 to 60, 65. Usually couples or retirees. Depending on the country, sometimes from Singapore, for example, we got a lot of family offices or young professionals. And in Thailand, we've got family offices as well. In the USA, it's more single professionals than couples. Australians are usually, a typical customer are usually young couple, not young, sorry, middle-aged couple.
Mm-hmm. And what are they buying?
And they usually start off with one or two smaller units just to test the waters. Go on for about a year or two, they see that the income is coming in and they can repatriate whenever they want. And then they say, okay, we've got another 100,000, should we buy a small building or a few other units that we can spread out, just depending on their personal criteria. Depends on the portfolio you've got in other countries too. Like if you've got something in Australia that's nice and safe and stable but generating low rental yield, and you might want to hedge with something that's a bit higher on the cash flow in another country. And if you've got nothing on the other hand, we probably recommend, I know that the cheaper would recommend to stay safe and stable close to city centers even in Japan. So you might be making 6 or 7%, not 9 or 10, but you'll never have to worry about tenants. And then once you've established this safe and stable portfolio, then you can be a bit more adventurous in the edge of Japan. It's really up to the investor.
So Zip, you're going to tell us about how we can get cheap money in Japan?
How you can get?
Cheap money to fund all these things?
Cheap, yes, but it's not easy. So at the moment, the only, and that's only started a year or two ago, the only arrangement that we are aware of is to set up a Japanese company. Yeah. Can be either a company, a native Japanese company with a local nominated CEO, or it can be a branch of a foreign company, in which case the CEO doesn't have to be local. And then you apply for essentially a business loan. It's not a real mortgage. You're applying for a business loan. If you've already got assets that you've purchased in Japan and that are fully paid for, You can use those as securities and get up to about 80 or 90% of the value of that asset. If you've got nothing, there are a few of the bigger banks that will give you a loan even without a Japanese asset or income history. But they'll want you to start at a million and they'll only give you 40 or 50%. So if you're happy to put down $500,000 or $600,000, they'll give you the extra $4,000 or $5,000. Otherwise, it's still difficult. Once you've established an income stream in Japan and you've got a year or two of documented income, it becomes a bit easier.
What sort of
million?
What sort of interest rates are we talking?
With the bigger banks, they're about 3.2. With the smaller banks, about 3.2. If you get in with the mega banks, it's about 2.4, 2.5. So pretty good rates, but again, it's quite hard to qualify. And you need to come in person for a meeting with the bank, show them your ID, they want to make sure you're not a money launderer or what.
Which fee do you recommend, or which fee we shouldn't touch? Because we are, you said here Tokyo is nearly the price, which is the last.
Well, again, it really depends on your criteria, right? So, if this is your first time purchasing in Japan and you want to play it safe, Central Fukuoka or Central Osaka or Central Tokyo are good, but the cash flow will be quite low. So Central Tokyo and Osaka will be maybe 4% if you're lucky. Central Fukuoka, 5.5 or 6. Other big cities like Nagoya or Sapporo, sometimes Kawasaki, Yokohama if you're lucky, can generate slightly higher returns. But they can be problematic. Like Sapporo, for example, have got a lot of areas that have been overbuilt in recent years. That's starting in Fukuoka as well. And then it becomes a case of, well, newer developments are available for similar rent, then you have to lower your rent because you've got an older property. It becomes a bit of a race to the bottom with the other landowner. You've got 5 vacant properties and they keep dropping every week because everybody wants to be the lowest.
A bit like Brisbane at the moment.
So there's ways around that. If you don't want to enter that race, so you can try to rent it out as a monthly mansion, meaning short-term rental, but 1 month at a minimum. You can get higher rent for that, but then you have to furnish the place and provide Wi-Fi, internet, that sort of thing. And city-wise, Nagoya is good, Fukuoka is good. Fukuoka returns are a bit lower, but it's a very good profile city. Nagoya returns can be higher, but the tenants are a bit rougher, so a lot of blue-collar industrial sort of manufacturing tenants. Again, no forced evictions, you know, they're not going to blow a place up or run a drug lab in it, they're still Japanese, but they just could have more payment issues once in a while. Move out a bit more frequently than other people, that's all. And medium cities that are quite good are Kumamoto, Kurume, and Kyushu. We sometimes see something good in Kyoto. Nagasaki occasionally, Chiba, but depending on the location, because Chiba can be quite agricultural as well, so you want to stay close to the industrial, to the centralized area. There's quite a few of them.
Are there restrictions on foreign ownership of agricultural land?
No. You just have to report the foreign purchase to the Bank of Japan. They keep track of who's buying what.
Yeah.
So that's it. No, you're in fact exempt from some local municipality fees when you're not a resident. Just peanuts, but there's no limits whatsoever. But again, practical management, you want to open a bank account, you want to, online banking is only in Japanese, even if you do manage to open a bank account, you want to work with someone, you have to look hard. Like, you know, in other countries, if you go to, even in Asia anyway, you go to the USA, to Thailand, to, I know Australians like to buy in Bali or Phuket or what have you, there's going to be a host of people who are dying to work with you. They all speak English, they all try to sell their goods. You have to sort of pick the reliable ones. In Japan, it's exactly the other way around. So everyone's reliable, everyone's trustworthy, everyone's honest, or almost everyone, there's bad apples everywhere, but you have to work very hard to find somebody who will agree to work with you. Because it's a counterintuitive environment, that's all.
Questions? Thank you, Zid.
No worries.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's it from us today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this Q&A session in spite of the initial audio issues. If you've got any questions or requests for clarifications about anything you've heard here today or in previous episodes, do feel free to drop us a line or a comment wherever you may have found this recording. And please do share this podcast with your own networks if you think they may find it interesting. And as always, we'd really, really appreciate it if you could rate this podcast on the iTunes Store, the Google Play Store, YouTube, or again, wherever you may have found us. Thanks again for your time. Wishing you a fabulous new week. And until next time, happy investing.